Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we bring you the first event in the lead-up to the 2026 Camden Conference this February on the theme Power, Politics, and Players in Today's Middle East. Nick Schifrin, PBS NewsHour's foreign affairs correspondent and award-winning combat journalist, shares a powerful and very personal account of his work as a war correspondent. His talk, Tell Me About Your Son, was recorded live at the Camden Opera House on August 16, 2025. It was moderated by Camden Conference President Matthew Storin. Before we begin, a quick note that today's conversation about the importance, ethics, and challenges of covering war includes mentions of torture, rape, and violence.
Thanks for being here. I'm Matt Storin. I'm the board president of the Camden Conference. And I want to welcome you to this great opportunity to hear Nick Schifrin talk about his job covering war and conflict for the PBS NewsHour. Some of you, perhaps many of you, probably think you saw Nick in Alaska last night. And he was there. And he made an extraordinary effort to get here because, as you know, none of this was planned, and we really appreciate that. Now, about Nick. We're delighted to be able to host for the second time in almost exactly a year this courageous and highly respected correspondent. I guess, Nick, we should now call you favorite son of Camden. His talk is entitled, Tell Me About Your Son, Staying Resilient While Covering War. Obviously a fascinating topic. I think this title captures what is distinctive about Nick. His work is always marked by empathy and humaneness that is rare among people in his line of work. But we can ask him about that in the question and answer period that will follow his talk. And just a brief word about his background. He covered Afghanistan and Pakistan for ABC News from 2008 to 2012. He was also Al Jazeera's American Middle East correspondent from 2013 to 2018, based in Jerusalem. And we could spend the next 10 minutes listing all the awards he's won, but I'm sure that you and he would like to get on to the business at hand. Since it takes a village, I think it's important to note that Nick's wife, Kamala Schick, is also a journalist, a foreign affairs producer for CBS, and they have two young children and an English Cocker Spaniel. Please welcome back to Camden, Nick Schifrin.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Matt. Yes, the Cocker Spaniel and the kids and my wife are at home. God bless them. Thank you, everyone, for being here. It's such a pleasure to be back in Camden. First time since last August. It's been a long decade this last year. A lot of people ask me what has changed in Washington in terms of how I report at the Pentagon, the State Department, Foreign Affairs since January 20th. And my answer is that I use Signal a lot more. Let that one roll to the back. As Henry Kissinger would say, the benefit of that story is it's actually true. It has been a challenge to cover the Trump administration, but also a great opportunity and privilege, and perhaps accidentally or not, foreign affairs has really come to dominate the news cycle once again. And Matt and I, as he said, we'll talk more about the Middle East, Ukraine, Anchorage. Yes, I was there last night. That wasn't a green screen. But first, I want to talk about something a little more personal, and I do want to start in Ukraine. Because in late 2022, I found myself in a small city in eastern Ukraine called Balaklia. Ukrainian soldiers had just liberated the city's 25,000 residents from Russian occupation. In the middle of the town stood a Ukrainian police station that the Russians had turned into one of their headquarters. We walked inside with Ukrainian police investigators, the equivalent of CSI, and began what I can only describe as a tour into the heart of darkness. The Russians slept in the basement, which when we arrived that day was lined with cots and discarded Russian cups of noodles. Above, on the ground floor, Russians had detained Ukrainian men in small cells of solitary confinement. Each cell was about 5 feet wide by 10 feet long. On one of the cells that had held a Ukrainian man, he had scratched a line on the wall for every day he'd spent in detention. There were more than 30 scratches. In another cell, a Ukrainian prisoner had scratched the Lord's Prayer, imprisoned in his own country, including the line, "Deliver us from evil." Then we went upstairs. The Russians had commandeered the police commander's offices and turned them into torture chambers. The Russians had not cleaned up before they fled. They left behind the wire that they used to strangle, the broken off baton that they had used to beat and sodomize, and the electricity source that they had used to electrocute, the devices of dehumanization. The police then took us to a nearby graveyard. There were dozens of rows of smartly dug graves, each marked with a gravestone or placard depicting the names of the dead and the years that they had lived. But at the edge of the graveyard, the rows and the gravestones stopped. Neatly dug graves had been replaced by mounds of dirt, each side by side. No markings, just an occasional cross above hastily dug graves. And under one of those mounds of dirt lay a Ukrainian named Maxim Shalikin. A few months before, Russian occupiers had tortured Maxim in that police station, murdered him, and gave his body to his brother to hastily bury. On the day my team and I visited, grave diggers began digging. Not a new grave, Maxim's grave. The police needed to exhume his body in order to document his torture. There were a few journalists there, including my small team, as well as police investigators. And among those also watching this scene was a woman in her 50s named Svetlana, Maxim's mother. She watched the unwatchable. The son she had birthed dug out of what was supposed to be his final resting place. Police prodded his body. It was awful. The scene, the disgust on her face, the smell, I can still close my eyes and see it and smell it. In its dehumanization of its perceived Ukrainian enemies, Russia had stolen the dignity from even the dead. I walked away. I sat behind a small shack and I cried. I had witnessed Svetlana watching Maxim's grave. But I had seen my wife over our son's grave. And I had seen my mother over my own. I can still see Svetlana. I can still see so many scenes of trauma across a dozen war zones or natural disasters, from Ukraine to Hurricane Katrina, from Pakistan to Gaza. I can still see so many scenes of loss. Svetlana's trauma is unspeakable. What of the trauma of those who tell her story? The journalist, the translator, the camera person who interrupts one of the single worst moments in her life and has to ask her a question. How are you doing? How are you feeling in this moment? Please tell me about your son. Tell me about your son. The nature of that question, that request, is the core of the challenge that confronts journalists who cover trauma. How dare we ask her a question at all? How do we convince her to answer? How do we ask a question without exploiting her and her son, without forcing her to relive her trauma? And how do we, in turn, stay resilient while exposing ourselves to her pain? If we are to be good stewards of her story, we must make sure her answers are met with empathy. If we are to be resilient as we share stories of horror, we must believe that by asking her questions, we are not exploiting Svetlana, but instead, in fact, creating empathy in our audience for her and her son. We must believe that by asking Svetlana about her son, he transforms from a statistic into a story, from an anonymous victim into a person whose name you now know. We must believe that by sharing Svetlana's story, we are recapturing that which the Russians twice stole, her son's dignity, her son's humanity. Tell me about your son. To do what we do and remain resilient, we must believe in the catharsis of storytelling, that our own empathy, which allows us both to tell her story and makes us vulnerable, can also become the journalist's shield. The author Leslie Jamison wrote a book of essays called The Empathy Exams. Jamison learned about empathy as a medical actor. She plays sick. Her role is a 23-year-old patient for a psychiatry medical student. The patient that Jamison plays is suffering from seizures, but she does not realize that her seizures are the product of her brother's recent death. She thinks it's biological. So the students, of course, ask Jamison questions and try to understand the source of her seizures. Afterward, Jamison judges how well they did and whether they took multiple steps required to unlock the secret of her disorder. The first step that students are required to take when they hopefully discover her brother's recent death is to voice empathy. Whether they actually say, "I cannot imagine. That must be so hard." But that alone is not enough to help Jamison's character realize the source of her seizures and therefore allow her students to pass. To do that, they must demonstrate an empathy that goes beyond exhibiting compassion. They have to voice compassion and ask the right questions. They must learn about her brother's death and understand the timing of her seizures and put a puzzle together that for her character is still scrambled. In other words, empathy isn't only about saying that's hard or I cannot imagine. Empathy is about figuring out how to shine a light on trauma so it can be seen in the first place. And empathy is not about listening. It's also asking the questions that need to be listened to. The word empathy comes from the Greek. Em means into, pathos means feeling. Into feeling. It's a kind of travel into a person's feelings, into a person's pain. The psychiatrist Heinz Kohut, who advocated for empathy within psychoanalysis for decades, put it this way: empathy is vicarious introspection, the capacity to think and feel oneself into the life of another person. Surely that's what we journalists must do to share someone's story. We don't ask the traumatized to relive their trauma. We've been trained not to do that. We invite them to share their trauma with us. We invite them to share their story with us, their memories, the awful moments that have brought both of us to both the victim and the storyteller to this moment. We invite them to tell us what happened, but also their fears, their hopes. In other words, we ask them to unveil the very attributes that make them and us human, that give us and them dignity. Tell me about your son. We sit with our characters, probe their memories and emotions, not to exploit, but to understand, to unlock that which is vital to share. And to tell their story, we must demonstrate a willingness to travel into their pain. We must not only voice empathy, but figure out which questions to ask. We must find the trauma so we can understand it, and then communicate it, hopefully in a way that is memorable and meaningful to our audience. And if I want my viewers or readers or listeners to care, then I better hell care too. I have cried countless times during interviews. I hope, I believe, they're not crocodile tears. I cry because despite having covered multiple conflicts, I am still shocked by what some people, governments, armies, insurgencies, but ultimately people, are willing to rot on their fellow human beings. I cry because I still feel the pain of loss, even if I maintain the ability to leave the community at war, a privilege my interviewees do not. My visit is temporary, their loss is permanent. I cried with another Ukrainian north of Kharkiv following Russia's full-scale invasion, a man named 65-year-old Anatoly Krapach. We were visiting an area that had been recently liberated by Ukrainian soldiers, and the Russians left behind more horror. A Russian tank had fired on a car carrying a family trying to escape north of Kharkiv City. The shell destroyed the car and killed Andriy and his 9-year-old daughter, Ksenia. The burned out shell of a car that carried that family that day sat on a road, on the side of the road, for 6 months until Ukrainian soldiers liberated the community and investigators and journalists, including myself, arrived to document Russian war crimes. But Krapach was not on the scene as an investigator. Krapach was Andriy's father, the grandfather of Ksenia, the man and little girl who were killed in that car. Tell me about your son. I'd like to think that I proved I was willing to travel into his pain, because he told me about Andriy. He was a businessman, family man. He had dreams that would forever be deferred. Anatoly Krapach and I had a good cry. I asked him, "Why are you here? Why are you exposing yourself to the scene of the crime, the site where your son had been murdered?" He said something that I can only understand now that I'm a parent. He said, "How could I not be here?" Being there is what the journalist does as well, and yet that is exactly what makes us vulnerable to post-traumatic stress. In my experience, the extent of my injury, and it is injury, correlates directly to how deeply I went, how far I traveled into people's pain. That seems to me a genuine occupational hazard. That which allows us to do our jobs is the very thing that creates burnout, that leads us to become overwhelmed or self-destructive. I'll admit, I've not always been good at self-care. I lived in Afghanistan and Pakistan for 4 years, and my embeds with American troops in Afghanistan, beginning in 2008, were my first exposure to combat. My first exposure to the threat of injury or even death. I too, of course, am a son. And my father was so against war, he banned squirt guns from our house. So Afghanistan was a very far place from Southern California. And in that initial war correspondent job, I responded by, it's a cliche, drinking a lot, partying a lot, burning the proverbial candle at both ends. And I saw many of my fellow war correspondents doing the same. They spun amazing stories, but also tales of broken marriages, multinational children living far apart, families broken by the addiction to the adrenaline of combat reporting. I look back and acknowledge that perhaps I coped with my feelings, but failed to understand or confront them. Perhaps I didn't empathize with myself. Over the years, I've tried to cope in different ways and now understands now understand that the mechanisms of coping are largely divided into three. One, the self-care that you might have read about in books. Exercise, yoga, Pilates, whatever it is that moves your body, allows you to literally sweat out some of the stress. If sublimation of vice into acceptable behavior, as Freud put it, helps create modern civilization, surely we journalists can take an exercise class every now and again. There are other personal self-care steps, including anything that you could consider meditative. Dan Harris, a friend of mine who left ABC News after he wrote a wildly successful book and created a podcast about meditation called 10% Happier, points out meditation is the act of simply being present 100%, of thinking about what you are doing only about what you are doing in the moment you're doing it, even if you are turning a doorknob or brushing a teeth. It resets the brain. I've come to believe that all resets or breaks are important. Coffee breaks, breaks from telling traumatic stories. I step away from the place I work, where I too often discuss trauma or witness trauma. Step away from the front lines, step away even from combat reporting entirely, at least for a little while. There is also, secondly, structural coping, therapy, collaboration. I've sat with a lot of therapists. The only people who I've ever talked to who are disinterested, not uninterested. She or he has no dog in the fight, professionally trained to help me understand. There's also no substitution to talking to colleagues about what we've seen and how we are coping or whether we are not. But those personal and structural coping mechanisms, I've come to believe, are not enough. Come to believe that the third form of coping is the most important, to believe in the importance of our craft, to believe in a catharsis in storytelling. And to make this last point, I'm a journalist, so perhaps again, one last story, and because I am, as I've said, also a son. In 2014, during what at the time was the largest war that Gaza had ever seen, I was live on TV in Gaza City. And the sound of explosions overwhelmed the sound of my voice. The Israeli bombs had gotten so loud, viewers couldn't even hear me. So I said to the anchor, I would wait until the explosions stopped. I stared into the camera for, I don't know, a few seconds, probably, I mean, like an eternity in television time. I remember trying to keep my face neutral, but the anchor's face went absolutely white. He apologized to our viewers for, quote, keeping me out there, and don't worry, Nick will get to a safe place, as if there's a safe place in war. And a few minutes later, my phone dinged. It was a text message from my mother, who unfortunately had been watching. She wrote, "You can't go before I do." It took me years to admit that I'd been naive in assuming that I could become a war correspondent and not emotionally harm myself or my family. Gaza, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Ukraine, the locations are like merit badges on a war correspondent's sash. They are also each scars that take years to heal for me and many people around me. During periods of doubt, I have wondered whether my reporting was worth the risks and the costs. I've lost relationships, become disconnected from people I loved, and burdened my nearest and dearest with anxiety created solely by my choice of career. And at times, I have wondered whether I was motivated by the thrill rather than the substance of the story. But I have come to believe that I have been graced with an empathy gene, and therefore an opportunity a privilege, perhaps a responsibility, to not only listen, but also to ask the right questions. And I have come to believe that the empathy I exhibit in order to share people's stories also helps steel me by providing me purpose. Writing Svetlana's story allows me to process the trauma to which I'd been exposed. It's not dissimilar to how Freud talked about his talking cure. By expressing feelings, we remove the lid of a pan to prevent it from boiling over. Sharing Svetlana's story provides the reason for my taking risks, for putting my family through the pain of having to watch me stay silent as the missiles flew. One day, when I brought up my own trauma and my fear that I had caused my parents' trauma, they admitted they wouldn't mind, perhaps, if I covered less conflict. But they told me they, too, believed in my work. My father scribbled a message on the back of our lunch receipt that I still carry with me, the doctor's chicken scratch that became a totem of conviction. The only thing that will disappoint me, he wrote, is if you disappoint yourself. And finally, the very act of meeting Svetlana is a reminder of Joan Didion's instruction. We tell ourselves stories in order to live. But unlike for Didion, who meant we delude ourselves in order to survive, I believe we tell stories to remind ourselves what it is to live. We tell stories to recapture lives that have been lost. We share Svetlana and Maxim's story to transform torture into the tale of an individual family, to recapture stolen dignity, to humanize that which has been dehumanized. Tell me about your son. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker is PBS NewsHour's foreign affairs correspondent, Nick Schifrin. His presentation, the kickoff event for the upcoming Camden Conference this February, is titled Tell Me About Your Son, Staying Resilient While Covering War. Stay with us for a Q&A led by Camden Conference President Matthew Storin.
The media comes in for a lot of criticism, and some of it merited. I wish millions could have heard that, but I think that we've been privileged here in this arena to hear that tonight. And I want to, we're going to go to questions in just a second. I thought I would ask one to give people time to screw up their courage to stand up and ask. And I know this audience, and I know we'll have many good questions. There are many issues that are out there. I wanted to take advantage of your empathy gene because you've made many trips to Ukraine. And I think whatever issues there might be about America's support, the level of its support, whether it should have been involved in the beginning, that we have to admire their patriotism and their resilience.
Yeah.
And I wondered what you've learned about the Ukrainian people that brings us and brings them to that level of dedication.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a great question. And not only about what I've learned, but frankly, what Ukrainian people have learned about their own identity. And thanks to everyone again for being here. So I've been to Ukraine many times, starting since 2014, when what we call the Revolution of Dignity, the Maidan Square uprising, started in late December 2013, led to the ousting of a pro-Russian president. And in 2014, Putin and Russian forces not only annexed Crimea, but also inserted the military and some proxies into eastern Ukraine. And I traveled throughout eastern Ukraine in the weeks, and Crimea, in the weeks after the Revolution of Dignity, and saw divided cities. I would go to Kharkiv, used to be the second largest city in Ukraine, the largest city in the East, and I would be able to walk from or between the pro-Russian camp, which was on one side of the square, and the pro-Ukrainian camp on the other, one side, well, both sides speaking Russian, but, you know, talking about Ukraine and the West on one side, talking about Moscow and World War II on the other. After the full-scale invasion in 2022, that divide ended. And I'll tell you a story about a family I met who were leaving one of the suburbs of Kyiv as it was being bombarded, and they come in and they give us an interview, and the woman starts speaking Ukrainian. And my translator, God bless him, Volodymyr Solohub, who I've known since 2014, says to her, you know, you don't have to speak Ukrainian. He doesn't even know the difference. Not entirely true, but close enough. And she said, absolutely not. I am not speaking the language of my oppressor. And my daughter will never speak Russian. It's a small anecdote, but very revealing to me that the country that we cliche used to describe as linguistically, culturally, historically, politically divided, that's gone. And so, you know, the analysis essentially is that Putin had the illness right, that Ukraine was drifting west, but his prescription, his medicine, so to speak, has forever turned Ukraine and Ukrainians against Russia. And so I think that is what I've learned, but that is really what Ukraine has learned. You know, I did a story that compared Lincoln's words in the Gettysburg Address, so a nation can be born, with a phrase that Zelensky used on the first New Year's Eve speech after February 2022. And he said almost exactly the same words. We have learned what we are as a nation.
Excellent.
Thank you so much, Nick Schifrin. It's a thrill to see you in person. I'd like to ask you about something that you haven't spoken about, which is how you feel and use this empathy that you've described in a studio when you're interviewing someone whose politics you find abhorrent. I've seen you do it, and you're the best, at least related to public radio, that I've ever seen. What goes on inside you? What is that like?
I've been dying to use a Ted Koppel line one day. Ted turned to Donald Rumsfeld one day and said, "Sir, my chair has wheels, and the more you spin, the more dizzy I get. So let's try that. Let's try that question again," right? So that's Ted Koppel, right? Ted Koppel is a legend and can never be replaced. And I should say, you know, Ted's been very generous with his support lately, so thank you, Ted, and his family and his wife. But that's really actually not my approach. I hope Ted is okay if I disagree with him, because I actually do think that my willingness to accept that somebody there whose politics, as you say, I abhor, I'm not sure I would use that word, but you know, we all have opinions, right? I'm not a robot, whose politics I don't agree with or whose ideas I don't agree with, but I still believe it worthwhile to understand them. And that's actually, I would argue, less about my own empathy, although I think that's my natural position. But Jim Lehrer used to say that. Jim Lehrer had a saying, which is, if I've asked you to come on the program, I'm going to give you the chance to say that which I expect you to say or want to say. So, you know, God bless Jim, he had like 18 minutes to do interviews. I have six. But, you know, there's another NewsHour saying, we don't throw curveballs, we throw fastballs. Like, I will always ask a question so that someone can feel like they got their talking points or they got what they wanted to say. And then fine, I'll challenge them, no curveballs, fastballs. And so I guess that's my approach. You know, whether it comes across as empathetic or neutrality, I mean, you know, that's so subjective, it's in the eye of the viewer. But I hope that you guys don't know my politics. And I hope that I never seem disdainful or dismissive. Respectful and challenging is perhaps how I approach it. And perhaps a little bit is the belief that everyone deserves the right to be understood, you know, even if you might disagree with them. Yeah.
We'll go upstairs, number four.
Hello there. I did have a question about, well, your job specifically. You talked a lot about empathy and how that's clearly important and how you as a journalist have to convey that to an audience and how that affects people. But given this sort of idea that is in the mainstream that a lot of jobs could be replaced, how do you feel of the idea that your job could also be replaced as well, instead of having people on the ground being in danger and having loved ones be concerned for your safety? It would be a machine, a robot, you know, one of those spot mini dogs walking around with a camera and, you know, talking to people. Would that be a trade-off that you'd be willing to give, or do you think that that's still important that a person is there to observe the phenomena?
It's so interesting. I do get asked about AI a lot, and that's the first time that anyone's asked me that. It's really interesting. Perhaps I am being naive. And, you know, anyone who's seen, let's see, Terminator 2, you know, the scene where Arnold goes down and the son's crying, right? So maybe robots can create empathy. But I'd like to believe that there is something that I can try and create with somebody that doesn't come out of an equation. So if I were an AI robot trying to create empathy, I would know the person's language, speak exactly like they do, look like them, reflect them, whatever it is that somebody in a lab can think, do all the 100 things to create empathy, check, 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 and I have a life-size robot and AI, whatever, spit it out. But that's not actually what creates a willingness to talk. It is the act of humanity to tell somebody with my eyes, I do not understand, well, that's not true, I don't understand most of what you're saying. I don't come from your culture. I don't share your history. And I just got here, and I'm gonna leave. But there is something in how I ask my question and I look at you that proves that I give a shit. That's why people talk. Maybe a robot can do that one day, but I'm skeptical.
Hi, I wanted to thank you. I was just extraordinarily moved by your discussion, your conversation about the importance of empathy and what it means to you and why it's so important to you and what you say.
Thank you.
And I wanted to put in a plea for it, not just in the sense of foreign correspondence and foreign affairs, but also within our domestic civil affairs, because I think the importance of empathy, as you were talking about a few minutes ago, of actually listening to the other, even if you may not hold the same viewpoint. Yeah. I cannot think of a time in my life when there has been such an important need for empathy like that in our public discourse. And I laud you for that, and I hope that we see and hear more about that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. If there's any bias that I am guilty of, it is toward humanity and trying to understand rather than condemn. And it's a shame, you know, I don't watch a lot of TV news, but, you know, I see, you know, what gets ratings is people yelling at each other. And, you know, it's just not what we do, not what we believe in. And so, you know, the more understanding and willingness to understand, even if you disagree, obviously, would go a long way in this country and everywhere right now. So, thanks.
Number one. Hi. Thank you very much for that moving presentation. It just added another dimension to the flat screen that we see you on. But
gotta work on holograms.
Looking back at your experience with Al Jazeera English, do you have a view or an insight as to how Al Jazeera English compares, or how they develop their stories compared to the ones, the Al Jazeera Arabic, which is addressing a different audience altogether? We'd appreciate that.
No, I don't have any insight or necessarily views to talk about in terms of the difference between English and Arabic. You know, I do think it's important that U.S. officials understand how powerful Arabic is, and I'm not sure that's really appreciated. I do think President Trump, this is totally non sequitur, but has in the past acknowledged imagery, like, right? He's so focused on pictures, and the times he's criticized Bibi, including by yelling at him, literally, for Bibi trying to convince Trump that there's no starving in Gaza, and Trump completely dismissed him and yelled at him over the phone. You know, the president understands the power of imagery. He may not understand how powerful Al Jazeera Arabic broadcasting from Gaza is, but he does understand the power of imagery. Anyway, that's a bit of a tangent. You know, I think it's important that we understand the impact on not only the Middle East, but the world, when, you know, every night Arabic for sure is broadcasting live from Gaza over and over again, showing these scenes, but also English is broadcasting into, I forget what the numbers are, but, you know, millions and millions of views of homes. And so, you know, the world is seeing a version of Gaza that I think the United States media does a decent job of doing. The Israeli media almost never shows, actually, interestingly. That's how I'd answer your question. I think it's important to understand that in terms of the world opinion and how the United States positions itself moving forward and how that impacts U.S. stance, especially in the global south, when you get a lot of Russian Chinese media saying, look at the double standard. The United States supports Israel and used to have 100% support of Ukraine. Look at the double standard. We're more trustworthy, the Chinese, than the United States is. So they play on those images. So that's why it's important. Yeah.
Over here, number two.
So I want to say that as a journalist, I really appreciate the passion that you bring to the mission. My colleagues who I work for the Miami Herald, my colleague Julie Brown brought that passion to the Epstein story. What I wanted to ask you, though, is really about what do you see as potential paths forward in the Middle East, particularly with Palestinian nationhood, Israel? I can't see Bibi's ever going to go quietly on that. Where do you see the path forward?
Yeah, I'm pretty cynical, and most former Middle East correspondents are. Pretty cynical, as Matt knows, and as everybody who spent any time in the region knows. You know, so a U.S. official and I spoke recently about Steve Witkoff's efforts. He's leading his president's special envoy for whatever the president wants, which means Putin and Bibi, basically. And he thought that he had some progress about 3 weeks ago. They thought that they had a version of a deal that Israel gave a little bit, in the sense that there's 20 living hostages in 20 Israeli living hostages, or believed to be living, being held by Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad inside Gaza. And what Hamas agreed to and what Israel agreed to was a staggered release over 2 months. And the reason that Hamas wanted that is that the previous ceasefire was broken in the middle by Israel. And so Hamas wanted to essentially withhold the release of living hostages in order to incentivize Israel to get to the end of the 2 months. Anyway, there was great progress, and I think they were about a day away, actually. At least one of the negotiators who I talked to thought that they were a day away. And then Israel just walked away, and the United States endorsed that walking away. And so now where we are is a different place. Not many people I talk to are hopeful about any kind of ceasefire, let alone the Palestinian state, which is a whole other question, but I'll answer it briefly at the end. But a ceasefire in Gaza that would be that partial deal of, let's say, 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 3 months, where you'd get a staggered release of Israeli hostages from Gaza, you get a staggered release of Palestinian detainees currently in Israel, and you'd get a complicated but nonetheless spelled out withdrawal of Israeli forces toward the border of Gaza and Israel and toward the border of Egypt and Gaza.
That just isn't going to happen, according to the people I'm talking to. Israel is demanding all or nothing, basically, which means all 20 living hostages released on day one. Nobody thinks Hamas is willing to do that. Hamas has said it's willing to release all of them, including the dead bodies of hostages, only if the war ends and Israel completely withdraws. There's no way Bibi thinks would ever endorse that. Talked to a senior Israeli official when said senior Israeli official was in Washington recently. That doesn't give it away, but anyway. This official said, they think they can win. They think they can win. The IDF doesn't think so, by the way, but, you know, the politicians think they can win. And so if you get that combined with what is the obvious political dynamics, which is two especially far-right ministers threatening to bring down the government, if they don't not only finish the job, quote unquote, in Gaza, but perhaps, you know, reoccupy Gaza. And so you have this threat, is what I would call it right now, a threat to reoccupy Gaza right now, an IDF statement saying that they've got plans to encircle Gaza City, a Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, US-backed, that has a site where Palestinians could move into, which is in the south. So, you know, you kind of get where this is going, right? There's no guarantee that it'll end up in Israeli occupation, Palestinians being pushed to the border of Egypt, but certainly some Israelis want to see that. And where the US is, it's, you know, I think they're struggling to figure out how to move the ball forward. Obviously, many US officials are quite pro-Israeli, but I think the president wants to see a solution. Steve Witkoff wants to see a solution. You know, it's not an ideological Oval Office right now. This is, you know, the president to the peace, Nobel Peace Prize thing, he really does want to be remembered as the guy who ended the Gaza war and the guy who ended the Ukraine war. That's not fake. That is deeply genuine. They don't really know. And so the momentum is toward the Israeli plan. The momentum is toward no ceasefire. The momentum is toward some form of reoccupation of Gaza. And therefore, the movement of Palestinians south, and then enormous pressure on Egypt to open the gates, which so far they've refused.
What's going to happen to the PBS NewsHour as a result of the federal cuts?
I mean, that's a question for people above my pay grade, so I'll leave it to them. But all I can say is, you know, we're going to be here. We're going to keep on telling stories, no matter how few or how many resources we're able to collect, and so we're determined to do that. So.
Good. Number two.
I have to thank you also. Most people here, I'm sure, all watch you on the NewsHour, and you answered a huge question of mine just in your talk, is how does he do it? How does he live and report the way he reports? And it was fascinating to listen to your story. But I want to follow up on a question somebody else asked you about the idea of where people consume and how people consume their news, and how, you know, look around the audience here, we're skewing a little on the older side, I think. And younger people that I know, and even people in our age group of the audience, seem to take a lot of this, like YouTube and TikTok and Facebook, and this is where they're consuming things. And of course, I send everybody to the NewsHour, but how do you at the NewsHour or in actual journalism get to those younger people?
Yeah, yeah.
How do you bring them in and get them to question what's going on around them?
No, it's super important. I mean, there's, I would argue, a tactical answer to that and a strategic one. The tactical one is, you know, we're on TikTok, we do Instagram, you know, there's, you know, we have relatively long segments for the internet age. You know, they do clips and put them on. Like, there's a lot of little things that we do that, frankly, you know, is very interesting to the people who do them. I don't want to discount that, but it's just that. It's just little tactics. You know, and I'm asked this a lot, and I say to everyone who asks, yes, of course it's a problem, but guess what? 30 years ago, who was watching the network newscast? The average age was in the 60s too. right? Now it's fine. Now it's maybe 68 or 72 rather than 64, right? But remember, the youngest audience on television is Fox News, and it's 58 years old. That's the average. That's the youngest. And PBS is probably the oldest at 70, something like that. But that's the range. You're not even talking about 40-somethings, let alone 30-somethings, let alone 20-somethings. They've never watched regularly television news. So, you know, it's important to ask the question. It's important to figure out how to reach people. There's no brand loyalty anymore. There's, you know, interest in individual people. So I think, you know, we're beginning to acknowledge that. There's lots of little things. But I also think, and call me naive, this has been a problem for a long time, but content is king. If you make good content, people will find it. And again, maybe I'm being naive, but I really, really believe that. And so again, to everyone in my industry who blames TikTok or Mark Zuckerberg for killing the local newspaper, okay, well, maybe that's a criticism that can be examined. But for anyone who thinks that the existential challenge is because kids don't care, I say two things. One, Vice News, right? Fine, with $1 billion from Disney and Murdoch, they made great content that young people loved. And they made a lot of money and they were very self-destructive in the management, so that's why they're no longer there. But the proof is that people are interested in. And again, bottom line, there's so much content out there. The good stuff does rise to the top, I believe. And so we just need to be better at what we do.
Nick, thank you for setting the standard of humanity and the maintenance of human dignity as sort of the baseline of what you're trying to achieve. When you look around the journalistic landscape, where do you look for that? Where do you see that besides the PBS NewsHour?
So how do I answer that diplomatically? I have two kids and I have a busy job, so I don't watch much TV news. See how I answered that? But if you really want like my menu, I do find 60 Minutes Sunday morning, you know, still to be the best news shows on TV. I do watch all three evening newscasts, but I will admit that I watch only the foreign affairs segments, which means it doesn't take too long to watch all three. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I don't watch cable news. I don't consume it. So where do I go is the list is too long to list all the reporters, but there's just fabulous writers at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. It's so cliche to say those newspapers, but they really are very often extraordinary in the reporting they do, in the attention to detail, and especially at the Times, of course, the big narratives. The Atlantic, obviously, which has a tie-in to NewsHour, I do try and read. Not so much for empathy, but The Economist is invaluable. The Financial Times is invaluable to understand the world. But I will give a pitch for what my friends who are in the fiction business will remind us, is that actually resilience, there's been studies about people who read fiction are more resilient in their own life. Because even if it's 1 or 2 or 3 or 4%, if you read a book that exposes you, as I talked about, right, exposure to trauma, that exposes you to a version of trauma or a version of something bad, you are more resilient. And so actually, I look to fiction for my empathy. So, yeah.
Final question, number 4 up in the balcony.
Hi. Empathy, yes. Great. And the Democrats, liberals tend to be pretty kumbaya, but where's the outrage? I mean, where's the, call it accountability. I mean, the starving people. And, you know, did you become a war correspondent to advocate for peace? And is the role of the media to educate the public so that we can get to higher ground?
This answer will disappoint you. No. It is not my role to give you the higher ground. It is not my role to persuade you. If you want to be persuaded, if I wanted to be an activist, I would be doing something else.
Are you neutral about war? Neutral, unbiased, don't take sides, don't prefer the Russians and the Ukrainians? Are you neutral, unbiased, just the facts of war?
I mean, look, the Russians accuse me of bias all the time, so do the Chinese. So yeah, I mean, the bias is in each person's beholder. But as I've been talking about, I am not designed personally, nor is my job to provide viewers somehow a list of stories so that, you know, you can argue that one side's better than the other. I am trying to bring you the stories of people who need to be heard, because if we have empathy for each other, if we have understanding for each other, yeah, then maybe there'll be less war, sure. But I'm not here to pick sides, and I'm not here for my viewers to feel like I'm helping them pick sides. And call me naive, but it is not my job to persuade you. It is not my job to selectively choose who's a victim and who's not. So again, I don't take away anything from my friends or colleagues who are activists or politicians, you know, whether it's Gaza or Ukraine or Sudan, you know. Again, I'm not judging anyone for, you know, advocating that one side is right and one side is wrong, but that's just not my job. I am not here to do that. I am here to bring you stories so that you understand people better than you did 5 minutes ago, so that you can understand. So that you understand a line that I've used often, which is the opposite of war is not peace, it is humanity. It is understanding that the mother on the other side of the border cares as much about her son as you do.
Thank you, Nick.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a talk by journalist Nick Schifrin, PBS NewsHour's foreign affairs correspondent. It was recorded on August 16, 2025, at the Camden Opera House in partnership with the Camden Conference. Today's episode is available on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on Shows to find Speaking in Maine and many other on-demand programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.